When we spend some time looking at our minds in the way that we've been doing, it so quickly becomes apparent that there's a lot going on in there. A lot of things that we don't necessarily have control over. Things that we wish we could turn off. Say, oh, may that not arise anymore. And other things that we wish we could put our minds into those states. Oh yes, may peace and bliss arise in the mind. And we just see this stream of conditions and states of mind, a lot of which create and at least conduce to struggle, distress, suffering. And we see the dukkha, the suffering that is happening in our minds. And, you know, a lot of us do come to this practice with the motivation, you know, is there some way, this is even what the Buddha said, that suffering motivates us to search. Is there someone who knows a way or two out there to eliminate the suffering? Is there some way to release myself from this suffering? So it's very natural that this arise in the mind, that we see the way that our minds are creating suffering and wish to change it. Actually, I think when we start to recognize that the suffering, you know, when we turn and actually start to look at our minds and see, for instance, something like anger, and we turn and it's like, oh, this is anger. This is what's happening in this mind. Anger is happening in this mind. When we see that and we begin to recognize that, wow, that hurts. That's actually the beginning of insight. When I first started this path, actually the beginning of my meditation path happened because I was struggling with so much suffering, and in particular anger. And a friend sent me a book that suggested something along the lines of, well, just see if you can observe your anger. And my thinking was, well, what good is that going to do? Won't that just make me more angry to observe my anger? But what happened as I started observing the anger was that I saw I was suffering when this anger was happening. That was a surprise to me. I mean, it shouldn't have been in some ways. It seems duh, you know, but when I had been angry before, my whole orientation was focused outwards on the person that I was angry with, what I could do back to them, how I could prove to them that they were wrong and I was right. I was so focused on, and actually to my surprise and dismay at a certain point, seeing that I actually wished that person to be in pain, and that the whole focus of the anger was directed lashing out. And because of that outward lashing focus of the anger, I was unaware that that anger was causing me distress. And so this turning towards our reactivity, turning towards these states of mind in meditation, in mindfulness, opening to our reactivity, as we feel into these afflictive emotions, these difficult states, one of the first things we feel is the ouch of it. The, oh, that doesn't feel good. And that's where wisdom begins. That's where the learning begins, because we are taking in, how does that state impact this being? Whereas before we had, probably many of us, when we have desire and aversion, we are focused outward on the thing we either want or want to get rid of, the thing that we're angry at or hate or are confused about. We're focused outwards. We're not turned towards the experience itself. And as we turn that way, as we turn towards it, it is a moment, it is the beginning of wisdom and understanding to recognize the suffering of that, the pain of that here. The Buddha, in his description around these difficult states, these afflictive states, he had some suggestions for us. One of the words that's used often for these afflictive states of mind in the Pali is kilesa. And often that word, kilesa, well, the word kilesa, the root of that word, the Pali of that word as I understand it, means something like stain. Like you would say, you would describe a cloth that had stains on it as having kilesa. And so it's something that's obscuring or creating non-clarity or non-wholeness in. So, you know, this obscuration or this stain on a cloth, for example. But this description also indicates that work can be done to remove the stain. And in fact, in one text called The Simile of the Cloth, he talks about this scrubbing of a cloth to remove stains as an analogy for the work that we do in our minds to help let go of these reactive states. This word kilesa is often translated, it's translated in Bhikkhu Bodhi's discourses, the translation that Bhikkhu Bodhi makes of the suttas. Many translators translate this term kilesa as defilement. I think Alexis used this term the other day, and it came up in the group this morning. You know, what is this word? You know, I don't like that word. We don't tend to like that word, you know, defilement. It's kind of an archaic word in a way, and it has a connotation, perhaps that I don't know. It's like if there's defilement, it means I'm bad somehow. Whereas the understanding of kilesa is that really, they are visitors. They are not inherent in the mind. There's one place in the text where the Buddha says something like, the mind is luminous and radiant, but it is obscured by these kilesa, by these visiting kilesa. And so the understanding is that they're not something that are who we are, but there can be a transformation and a releasing. The the texts use a word around kilesa. And into this text, I just talked about it. I'll just read a little piece of it. First, he goes through a bunch of these kilesa. Ill will, anger, resentment, contempt, insolence, envy, avarice, deceit, fraud, obstinacy, conceit, arrogance, vanity. These are kilesa that stain the mind. And then he says, knowing that these are kilesa, one abandons them. So this word abandon, abandon is used with respect to these states of mind. And on all of those states of mind, basically the kilesa are states of mind that are rooted in greed, aversion, and delusion, confusion, not seeing clearly. And so there are many, many flavors of greed, aversion, and delusion. But all of these, what we could call afflictive states, reactive states, are rooted in these three basic states of mind, greed, aversion, and delusion. And the Buddha suggests knowing that they are basically unhelpful, these states of greed, aversion, and delusion really head us into suffering. This is essentially what the Buddha was interested in. In his path, in his journey, he started out by basically having the question, is it possible to be free of suffering? Is it possible? And so his entire search was around, what is it? What's happening? And he began to understand in his own mind that these movements of greed, aversion, and delusion were the source or the place where suffering was rooted. And as he began to understand and let go, explore ways to release, abandon those states based in greed, aversion, and delusion, he began experiencing, he began seeing this movement towards freedom. And so he talks about abandoning these kilesa. So I like this word, abandon. I thought about it a little bit, and you know, the word abandon, there's different ways that we use it, and sometimes the word abandon, we have kind of funny negative connotations with, because we talk about, you know, a parent abandoning their child, and that's not a good thing. You know, that's not a helpful thing. And yet there's also ways in which abandoning is something that is a helpful thing to do. You know, we abandon something. There are two key definitions, I think, that feel appropriate to me around abandoning a kilesa. And one is the word abandon used to leave a place because of danger. This is a classic abandon ship, you know. We leave the place. We leave the place because it's dangerous to stay there. So that's one meaning that we can see. It's helpful, you know. It's not helpful to stay somewhere where there's danger. You know, that we want to leave that. Leave the danger. Another way that I think we abandon something, when we understand it's no longer of value. You know, we might abandon something that's no longer functioning. You know, it's like, yes, that's not working anymore. I'll leave it here. You know, so there's this notion of understanding it's not valuable, not helpful. So these two pieces around these difficult states of mind, these kilesa, as we start to turn towards our experience, you know, turning towards these reactive states and seeing the suffering that is created here, you know, just that simple exploration that I made around the anger and saw, wow, that actually hurts. That's beginning to understand the danger of those reactive states. And before that, we may have a conceptual idea that it's not helpful to be angry, but we don't understand in the experience. And so this turning towards helps us to recognize the danger of these reactive states of mind. And also, I think, like, again, for myself, somehow, I remember in those early days of looking at that anger, watching that anger, I recognized at some point there was some part of my mind that thought it was going to help me. You know, I thought it was going to do something for me. It was going to make me, you know, prove my point to that person, or I don't know, you know. But there was some convoluted notion in the mind that somehow it was helping me. And again, you know, this turning towards the experience helped me to understand it doesn't have the value that I thought it did. So these two pieces, we understand the danger and we understand that it's not of value to us. So these, both of these two definitions or meanings of the word abandon bring in the notion of understanding. And in fact, in that text that I read, it said something like, knowing that envy is something that creates suffering in the mind, we can phrase it that way, one abandons it. And so it takes some level of understanding. It takes some turning towards an understanding before the abandoning can really happen. And I think sometimes as we begin to explore our mind states and see these reactive states, see these kilesa, see the frustration, the envy, the confusion, the irritation, the impatience, the name your favorite flavor of reactivity. When we see it, you know, part of us understands, oh, this isn't helpful, and we want to get rid of it. We want to do the abandoning. And we think in some ways that the work is in the abandoning. And yet, I think that much of the work lies in the understanding. We understand as we turn towards our reactive states, we need to understand them. Again, not in this way of indulging. Alexis made that beautiful distinction this morning between indulging and allowing. The indulging kind of re-cements, reinforces a pattern of reactivity. The allowing creates the conditions for understanding to arise. And so this turning towards these reactive states, beginning to be curious about them. these states are suffering, dukkha. The very arising of these reactive afflictive states, the very arising of greed and aversion are felt as suffering if we take a moment to look at it. And the Buddha encouraged us. He said, What we experience dukkha. What do we need to do about that? We need to understand it. The first noble truth, the Buddha said, we need to understand dukkha. Understand suffering. And so this is the work of the practice, very much. As we turn towards our reactive states, part of the way that wisdom grows is because we see, we feel the suffering of it. We begin to understand also that this is a state, something that is happening in the mind. Sometimes we might see, you know, as we pay attention in meditation, sometimes we see something that's happening in the world, and sometimes we find a lot of reactivity about that thing, and we feel a lot of struggle, a lot of suffering, a lot of figuring this is a problem, and what do I need to do, and how do I fix this, and how do I change this? And other times, that very same kind of thing, we see, oh, it's not so much of a problem. It's okay. I'm okay with that. And so we see that this is something happening in the mind. It's not inherent in what's out there that this reactivity arises. It's something happening in our own minds. This is really good news. If it were inherent that a particular situation in the world created suffering in our minds, if somebody could just push a button, it does sometimes feels like, you know, people push our buttons, right? You know, feels like, you know, somebody can make us angry. Fortunately, it's actually not what happens when we begin to investigate what's going on there. You know, somebody says something, and then there is a process that happens in our own mind of reactivity. Sometimes we can be more balanced. Sometimes we're less balanced. So many conditions leading to the fact of a reactivity arising. And so as we start to see, as we start to recognize that this is a process happening in the mind, and that this mind is suffering over this process, the mind itself actually begins to recognize and to understand that it's creating its own suffering. And as it sees that, there's a kind of a, I think in our system as human beings, in the organism as a human being, there is a kind of a homing mechanism for well-being. You know, the system wants to be whole. The system wants to be happy. The system wants to have well-being and ease and peace. And yet, we're operating with kind of confused information a lot of the time, with beliefs that, yeah, anger is what's going to make me happy. Anger is what's going to make me get what I want, not recognizing that we are suffering in the process. And so we begin to see this as we turn towards our reactivity. We start to see first that it's suffering here, and second that it's created here. And those two pieces, when the mind begins to understand those two pieces, so this is the understanding, the mind begins to orient towards the abandoning, because the mind naturally orients towards well-being. And when it gets good information, when it gets an understanding, a wise view, the understanding of this is arising because of causes and conditions, this reactive state is created in the mind, the mind itself begins to understand and navigate towards the abandoning. Abandoning is the result of understanding. And so understanding is really the work of our practice. And so how do we do that? The mindfulness is the basic tool. Mindfulness and wise view. And yet so many times when we turn towards our reactive states, it's not so easy to simply be with it. You know, it feels overwhelming or threatening. And so there are times, there are definitely times in practice when, and Alexis referred to this morning, times when, you know, the state is like this big wave and our capacity for mindfulness is like a little ripple. You know, if the reactivity is overwhelming our capacity to be mindful, that's a time to use some of our strategies for setting aside or putting our attention on something else, going out into nature, changing the channel, turning towards something that helps us to stabilize the mind, not orienting towards that difficulty in that moment. And yet so many times I think, so there are definitely times when it's appropriate to take action, to not turn towards a difficulty. If that reactivity is so strong, it's not really possible to be mindful. I sometimes had the sense of when I turned to pay attention to something, I would just get lost in the quicksand of it. I would just go down the rabbit hole of it. That's not the time to try to be mindful of it. And yet many times I think we have some kind of a belief or a hidden, unseen belief that it's not possible for us to actually be mindful of a difficulty. And so sometimes I think we can jump a little too quickly to saying, oh, anger's arising? Oh, that's too dangerous. Better not try to be with that. That'll swamp me. I'll go down the rabbit hole. Oh, let me turn to something else. I think we don't give ourselves enough credit for the power and the capacity that we do have sometimes. And so I think it's useful to check it out. You know, is there the capacity? One of the great benefits of the practice for me has been, you know, and especially this style of practice with Sayadaw Utejaniya, is really expanding the terrain into which I have trust and confidence that mindfulness can go. And in fact, you know, at this point, one of the key tools in my toolkit is that it is possible, theoretically, it is possible to be mindful of any state of mind. Maybe not in this very moment, but with some patience and curiosity and exploration, it is possible to discover how to be with any state of mind, anything in experience. Some mind states almost seem inherently that they are antithetical to mindfulness, like spacing out. Doesn't it seem like, you know, spacing out is the opposite of mindfulness? How would it be possible to be mindful while spacing out? Sleepiness, sometimes people can have that sense too around sleepiness. It's like, How would it be possible? You know, the mind is falling asleep. How could it possibly be that we can be mindful of sleepiness? I'd like to suggest, if you have the idea, I can't be mindful because X is happening, or it's not possible to be mindful of that, of this particular state of mind, don't believe that thought. See if you can turn the question around. Instead, ask, how might it be possible to be mindful of that state? When I find my mind caught or lost in a mind state, you know, rather than trying to immediately say, fix or change it, get rid of it, or, you know, pick some other mind state. When I wake up and find my mind kind of hovering in this netherland of some, you know, odd mind state, rather than thinking, oh, can't be mindful of that, I get curious. How might it be possible? Might it be possible to actually follow mindfulness into that, follow the mind into that mind state? Now, one example of this around spacing out. I was having breakfast one morning, and this was at home. I was just sitting at my kitchen table eating breakfast, and I kept noticing the mind spacing out. And at that point, I was trying to practice mindfulness, but in that moment, my agenda for being mindful meant paying attention to eating breakfast. And so I kept coming back. It's like, okay, eating breakfast, lifting the spoon, chewing, tasting. Whew, the mind would space out. Okay, wake up. Oh, come back, eating breakfast. That's where mindfulness is. My mind would space out. At some point, this happened enough that I got curious. It's like, well, what's happening here? Okay, might it be possible to follow the mind into spacing out? And actually, I discovered it was. So I was sitting there eating breakfast, and actually something about the paying attention to the breakfast helped me. It's like I could see the mind begin to lose touch with paying attention to eating breakfast. Kind of like the mind hits like, okay, yep, okay. And paying attention to taste. And then kind of beginning to feel the mind like lose touch with that. It's just this drifting, this feeling of the mind kind of moving into some zoning experience. And just like this feeling. And it actually kind of felt like the mind kind of hovered up here. It was kind of a buzzy feeling. But I could be completely aware of it. I got curious. It's like, rather than having the agenda come back to this, it's like, well, okay, I can see the mind letting go of paying attention to breakfast. Where's it going? Let's see if we can follow it. Way more often than you might think, it's possible to be with that, to be with where the mind goes. As I did that, as I explored that morning, noticing, you know, mind kind of buzzing, perfectly mindful of that, very aware. In that state of noticing that spacing out, the mind had kind of left the realm of breakfast, but in that place, there was a feeling of relaxation happening. So I was aware of that relaxation, that feeling of rest, and just watching that state. At some point, it ended. And then there was just this very natural awareness of sitting and eating breakfast. And what I recognized in that was that the movement to the spacing out, it's like the mind was tired. It needed rest. It was going to take its rest, whether I wanted to or not. You know, it was like it was going to do that. I had been, you know, forcing it to do something, and it's like, you know, well, I'm pretty tired. It took its rest. And when I allowed it to do that with mindfulness, it rested for, I don't know, it was in that state of spacing out like that for maybe 30, 40 seconds. And then it ended. And then the mind was quite alert and present with physical experience again. So that whole process showed me that sometimes, you know, sometimes when the mind moves into certain states, it's doing it to help us. And we can, we don't have to, you know, we don't have to always be in charge of what our mind is paying attention to. But our work is to see, can we be aware of what our mind is paying attention to, what our mind is doing. So some states, you know, feel inherently like they're non-mindful states, you know, but question that. How might it be possible to be present for sleepiness? It is possible to be present for sleepiness. Absolutely. It's way more possible than, it's mind-blowing. On one retreat, I was playing with the sleepiness, because there was so much sleepiness on that retreat, you know, just watching the mind move into that low energy place over and over again. And, you know, at some point, because the mind had gotten so familiar with being present for sleepiness, the mindfulness actually followed the mind into sleep, mindfully into sleep, and into a dream, mindful into a dream. I was like, wow, that's possible? That was one of those experiences that led me to think mindfulness can go anywhere. It can go anywhere. So don't believe the thought that it's not possible. A lot of our challenges, our reactivity, you know, we can have certain patterns or difficult states that seem so complex, so intertwined. You know, self-hatred and fear and loneliness and unworthiness, all just in this big mess. So sometimes our difficult mind states can have this very complex structure to them. When I first started experiencing these in meditation, you know, self-hatred, unworthiness, loneliness, I felt like they were a problem. I felt like they were in the way. This was not where the practice was. You know, the teacher said, it's not a problem, you know, just notice it. But I didn't believe them. I thought they were just being nice to me, and that actually, in order to actually deepen in my practice, all of that self-hatred had to go, and that there would be no way to have true insight into what, you know, the teachers were talking about, not self. How could I possibly see not self while I was having self-hatred? And so there was this, like, you know, sense that it was a problem, it was in the way. And yet, it is absolutely the case that whatever is happening is where the path unfolds. They're not, these states, these reactive states, are not in the way of practice. Understanding them is the practice. That is where insight arises. And so as these difficult states arise, often, quite often, there's a lot of attitudes around them. I mean, just the simple attitude of this is a problem, that's an attitude. You know, a relationship, it's like, yeah, I'm having this self-hatred, this confusion, this unworthiness. It's a problem. I don't like it. It's not only that I don't like it, but it's inherently in the way. That's an attitude. It was unseen. It was a belief in my mind that was unseen. And so we need to begin to check what's our relationship to our experience. Begin to uncover these beliefs that are operating in the background or reactions that are operating in the background. As we do that, as we explore that, you know, even simple ones like today in some of the groups, people were talking about, you know, experiencing anger and then recognizing, you know, I don't like that anger. You know, I there's the aversion, basically aversion to the anger. And so, you know, the movement is to kind of take that or open to see that when the attitude is operating in the background, when, you know, the sense of this is a problem is what's in the background, or I don't like this is in the background, that is kind of guiding the whole way of how we're paying attention. Likewise, something like this is what's supposed to be happening. I like this. I want this. I need to go here. This is where I have to go in order to be free. Likewise, that also, that greed can drive our choices, what we choose to do in our meditation. And so the practice is to begin to uncover the hidden agendas, the hidden views, as we check the attitude. And as those become more clear to us, it's like they come out of the background and then they come into the foreground, and we are aware that these attitudes are operating. As we become aware that the attitudes are happening, it's like instead of being the driver of the bus, it's like we've taken them out of the driver's seat. So they're no longer so much in like subconscious control of our choices and our direction of what we're doing. So just the simplicity of recognizing, oh, there's self-hatred and I think it's a problem. Right there, there's some freedom. Right there, there's already some ease that's possible. So many times in my practice when I've recognized, oh, I see what's happening. There's this experience of pain in the knee, or this experience of confusion and feeling of unworthiness, and I want to get rid of it. That's what's happening. Kind of like the mind can go, oh, there's pain and I don't like it. That's what's happening. Like, oh, okay, I can know that there's pain and I don't like it. So again, the practice is understanding, turning towards understanding our experience. Can we bring an interest to what's happening? Sometimes when we have a perspective, an attitude or a relationship that is entrenched or, you know, really believed in a way, you know, it's like my understanding. Well, yeah, okay. So they say it's not a problem that I'm experiencing these states of self-hatred, but I really don't believe them. You know, so I had this understanding. Yeah, okay, I'm seeing that it's a problem, but in the background, I really did think it was a problem. So sometimes these attitudes are kind of entrenched in our minds. So when we see that, it sometimes can be helpful to consciously bring in some wisdom, bring in some wise view. You're reminding yourself. There's several kind of perspectives of wise view that might be helpful. One of them might be This is nature. This is, to me, that what that means is, this is not just happening randomly. It's happening because of so many different causes and conditions that have come together. You know, that this thing that's happening, of course this is happening. Look at what's happened in the past. That's where I got to some around the self-hatred. It's like, oh, I see. Of course this is happening. This is nature. To me, even just dropping that phrase in, this is nature, kind of like, oh, right. You know, this is happening because of causes and conditions. It's not really, it's not me, it's not mine. It's simply conditions that are arising. It's a process that's unfolding. That reminder is very, very powerful. This is nature. Another one that's supportive is something along the lines of, you know, this is dukkha. This is suffering. For me, actually using the word dukkha is supportive. I remember when I was at Shui U Min at Saito Utejaniya's retreat center, a couple weeks into the practice, I was experiencing so much suffering, and there was a lot of confusion around, you know, what's going on here? And at some point, the mind turned and recognized, oh, this is dukkha. Oh, dukkha is happening. And somehow the use of that word, the framing of dukkha is arising, helped my mind recognize, right, this is what the Buddha said I was supposed to pay attention to. This isn't a problem. This is the path. Oh, right. Okay. Oh, dukkha. Okay. Wow, dukkha hurts. Okay. What's happening? What's happening in the body? What's happening in the mind? This is dukkha. Another reflection that's been very powerful for me in the last month or so that I'll offer you, see if it lands for any of you, is somehow whenever there's any struggle that's happening in the mind, there's this recognition that there's some kind of belief that's operating, some confused belief that's operating that the mind is caught by. And so I began actually in this process, it's like, oh, you know, seeing the arising of some kind of struggle. The mind understood, oh, you know, at first it was like, oh, the mind understood, oh, that I'm believing that something needs to happen. And so there was the recognition of, oh, this belief, that's kind of the source from which this whole pattern of not liking arises. And so I began recognizing that the patterns of suffering were arising because I was caught by some belief. And then I began noticing that when I was caught by that, caught by some kind of suffering or experiencing some kind of suffering, that I could just bring in, and this is a conscious bringing in of wisdom, you know, this bringing in right view. It's a conscious use of wisdom reflections in the mind. Bring in the reflection, there's suffering. The mind is believing some view here. I didn't even have to know what the view was. Just understand that it was caught by some belief. Oh, the mind is caught by a belief right now. And just that bringing in that wisdom allowed there to be so much space around whatever that pattern was that it was very easy to be with it and allow the understanding to unfold and the abandoning to happen. So this is the power of bringing in wise view. It can often create the conditions. What it feels like, viscerally, what it feels like is that space has been created around the experience so that we can be with it. We can start to investigate. We can start to meet it. And so investigating our difficult states of mind, You know, especially these ones that are so intertwined, so many different layers. We can often have the sense of, you know, like that one I described around self-hatred and unworthiness and loneliness and confusion, anger, fear, all of these kind of wrapped around each other. There can kind of be a sense of, you know, there's something in the middle of all of that. You know, dive in and find that thing in the middle, and that's what will free me. We can have that perspective sometimes. But really, what's asked for is just a very gentle holding of the pattern. It's like, if we think of the pattern as this big mess, big messy ball of stuff, it's like, just have really big arms, really gently hold it, and just see what's obvious. You know, some piece of that pattern might come to the surface, and you know, oh, there's that thread of confusion. Oh, there's that thread of unworthiness. So you see the various pieces of it without having to dive in and dig. Just a really gentle receiving. It's like just this light touch meeting. This is what investigation is like. It's like being a naturalist. You know, just witnessing what's obvious on the surface. If you're a naturalist, you go out into nature and you just observe the patterns of nature. You just watch how trees grow. You watch how patterns unfold, and you learn from the observation. There's another form of science where you go out and you cut things down and you chop them up and you put them into process, you know, look at what the cells are like, and that's another kind of science. This kind of practice that we're doing is more like the naturalist. A non-interfering observation, but a continued interest. What's this? What's this? What's this? You know, as you go out and wander in nature, if you spend every day walking the same path in the woods, you will learn something about the processes that happen there. Even without, as long as you're interested in observing what's going on, you'll learn something about the patterns. And very similarly in our minds, if we're interested in being a naturalist in our minds, if we're interested in just observing, oh, what's this pattern? How does this work? What's going on? If we're doing that very gentle, receptive awareness, the mind begins to understand the patterns and the connections and the conditions, because our minds do that. We don't have to try to figure it out, in a way. So to support this gentle meeting of experience, you know, so certain questions can be helpful. You know, what's obvious? Am I aware? Making sure that we are aware. And what's obvious? How does it make the body feel? What's the attitude? These kind of basic questions we've been exploring. Another interesting question to bring in sometimes is, what purpose is this pattern serving? Because sometimes there's a deeper underlying connection to, you know, so many of our patterns, so many of our reactive patterns are not wholly bad. You know, they actually, those patterns are often formed out of a wish to be happy, a wish to be safe. And so in those patterns, in those, you know, even in the midst of self-hatred, you know, there's a thread back to a wish to be loved, perhaps. You know, that's where it was for me, you know. It's like this wish to be loved. And that wish, may there be love, that's a wish that's very natural. And the other thread that is often present in these reactive patterns is some part of life is out of control, unreliable, subject to change. And this wish for happiness, this wish for safety, is like coming right up against the out of control, unreliable nature of experience. And that's where the reactivity happens. And so the reactivities are kind of these myths, or they're these confused strategies for dealing with the truths of unreliability, impermanence, out of control, and the very natural and wholesome wishes for love, for metta. And so there's this, you know, as we begin to open to these patterns, hold them, investigate them. And there have been times when I thought that, like self-hatred, for example, to me it felt like what needed to happen was like it was some kind of cancer and it just needed to all be cut out. I needed to take the scalpel and get rid of it. But in the exploration, in the meeting of it with this allowing, what the mind began to understand were these threads back towards metta and truth. And so this is too what this practice reveals. Even our reactivity, when we open to it, when we open to allowing, understanding, begins to point us to these deeper truths of wisdom and love. In some ways, these patterns are not going to go. I mean, if we're trying to get rid of these patterns by repressing them, partly because they have these truths and wishes, you know, we might call these the core wishes, you know, the wish for well-being, the wish for happiness. These are very natural, wholesome wishes. They get confused as they meet these truths of unreliability, impermanence, out of control. But the patterns, you know, if we're trying to do that, excising, cutting them out, they are not going to let us do that because they're connected to these deeper, wholesome wishes and truths. So understanding, basically to me, what the understanding of these patterns begins to do is it teases apart, and it's not something we do consciously. It's not like we figure out how this teasing apart happens, but it begins to the being with these patterns begins to, it's almost like melt away the reactivity and reveal both the truths and the love. So that it's almost like an enzyme. Somebody used that word the other day, and I really like it. It's like mindfulness and wisdom are an enzyme that transform our reactive mind states into something that is useful. It takes what's useful and pulls that out. Allows us to be informed by that. So it's time to stop. I'll just close by reminding you that these reactive states, these kilesa, are not in the way. They are the path as we see them with mindfulness and wisdom. The transformation happens through the understanding. That understanding allows the abandoning of the unwholesome, but the ability of the mind to open to the truth, the truths of impermanence without reactivity, to hold the truth of, or hold the wish for love without tightening. It's like our hearts stretch to hold both of those together, those truths of the way things are and the deep human wish for happiness. They can be there together without fighting each other. So thank you for your attention.